This book is not a guide, not a manifesto, and certainly not a self-help manual in the usual sense. Thus Spoke Zarathustra is a fire. It doesn't try to make you feel good about yourself. It tries to burn away everything false, shallow, and borrowed in you, everything inherited, everything unearned. Nietzsche did not write this book for the average person, or even for the average philosopher. He wrote, "This book belongs to the rarest of the rare." And he meant it. He didn't believe most people could understand this book, not because it's written in flowery language or packed with academic jargon, but because it requires something very few people are willing to do, the courage to face their own inner abyss. When Nietzsche wrote Thus Spoke Zarathustra, he was trying to create something that would reach beyond the typical way people thought about philosophy. Instead of offering abstract arguments, he created a character, Zarathustra, and gave him a voice like a prophet, a poet, a madman, and a visionary. Zarathustra speaks in parables and riddles with rhythms that resemble scripture more than science, and this was on purpose. Nietzsche wanted to deliver ideas so powerful they couldn't be explained, only felt, wrestled with, and lived through. This is a book that must be experienced as much as understood. It demands that you bring your entire self to it, and in return, it offers transformation, but only if you're willing to suffer for it. There are three major ideas that repeat and evolve throughout this book: self-overcoming, the death of God, and eternal recurrence. They aren't presented as conclusions, but as challenges. They're not meant to be agreed with. They're meant to shake your foundations and force you to answer the question, who are you when there's no one left to tell you who to be? The idea of self-overcoming is one of Nietzsche's most important concepts. It's the belief that growth, real growth, only comes through a process of internal struggle, not through comfort or positivity, but through inner rebellion. He believed that human beings are not fixed. We are not finished. Instead, we are creatures in the middle of a transformation. Man is a bridge, Zarathustra says, a rope stretched between the beast and the Übermensch, the higher human being. That bridge must be crossed, not through education or obedience, but through fire, through conflict, solitude, and the destruction of everything false within us. You cannot become who you truly are unless you are first willing to kill who you were told to be. The death of God, famously declared early in Zarathustra's journey, is often misunderstood. Nietzsche was not just making a theological point. He was describing the collapse of the moral and metaphysical foundations of Western civilization. The idea of God, whether you believe in one or not, represented something deeper. The belief in a fixed, universal truth that tells us how to live and what to value. But Nietzsche saw that this belief was dying. Science, modernity, and rationalism had eroded it, and now we were left floating in a world with no guaranteed purpose, no divine script. Most people hadn't realized it yet, but the ground beneath their feet was already gone. And this, Nietzsche believed, would lead not to liberation, but to nihilism, a spiritual sickness where nothing feels meaningful and everything becomes shallow, passive, and safe. And yet, Nietzsche didn't write this book to lament the death of meaning. He wrote it to provoke the creation of new meaning. And the final test of whether you've truly accepted that challenge comes in the idea of eternal recurrence, one of the most brutal, beautiful thought experiments in all philosophy. Imagine living your life again and again, exactly the same, for eternity. Every pain, every regret, every hour wasted or lived with full intensity, you relive it endlessly. If that thought horrifies you, you're not living right. If you can embrace it with joy, then you've created a life worth living. That's the standard Zarathustra holds you to. Not moral purity, not success, but eternal affirmation. Saying yes to all of it, not just the good parts. So this book is not just about philosophy. It's about existence. It doesn't give you answers. It burns away your illusions and then dares you to build something new from the ashes. Something personal. Something real. It's not written for everyone, But if you're still listening, if something in you hungers for that fire, then maybe it was written for you. After 10 years of silence, solitude, and meditation in the mountains, Zarathustra decides it is time to descend. This descent is both literal and symbolic. Zarathustra walks down from the high peaks where he has lived in isolation, but he is also descending into the chaos, confusion, and decay of human society. His goal is not to become a teacher in the traditional sense, nor to win admiration. He's not coming down with commandments or holy laws. He comes to plant a seed, a dangerous idea, in the hearts of those willing to listen. What he brings with him is not comfort, but a new challenge, one so radical that even he doubts whether anyone is ready for it. Zarathustra's first words are not philosophical arguments. They are metaphors, poems, and parables. He speaks in riddles because the truths he brings are not easily swallowed. They are meant to disrupt, to disturb, to shake people out of their slumber. His time in solitude was not wasted. It was a necessary withdrawal from the world, a preparation for the task of reshaping values. He has gone into the wilderness to free himself from everything borrowed: morality, religion, customs, even language. When he returns, it is with a new vision of what humanity could become, but also a clear understanding of how far it still has to go. In Prologue 2, Zarathustra delivers one of Nietzsche's most infamous lines: "God is dead, God remains dead, and we have killed him." This is not a declaration of atheism in the simple sense. Nietzsche is not concerned with the existence of a deity. What he's saying is far more radical. The idea of God as the center of morality, meaning, and truth no longer holds the same power it once did. Science, rationalism, and secular culture have eroded the foundations of belief. But instead of celebrating this, Nietzsche warns of what comes next: a cultural and spiritual collapse. The world has lost its grounding. Without the idea of God, everything becomes unmoored. Values lose their authority, purpose becomes uncertain, and people become vulnerable to emptiness. The danger is not that people no longer believe in God, but that they will replace God with nothing. This void, this loss of meaning, is what gives rise to the last man. In Prologue 5, Zarathustra presents this figure as the embodiment of modern mediocrity. The last man is not evil, he is not dangerous, he is something worse: comfortable, shallow, and unimaginative. He wants safety above all else. He avoids pain, challenge, and risk. He consumes pleasure in small doses, not out of joy, but to avoid discomfort. "We have invented happiness," say the last men, and they blink. This blinking, this image of passive, mindless existence, captures what Nietzsche saw as the real threat to the human spirit: not war, not violence, but spiritual laziness. The last man wants a world where everything is predictable, where nothing hurts, and therefore where nothing truly matters. But Nietzsche does not leave us with this bleak picture alone. Zarathustra has come to deliver an alternative, the vision of the Übermensch, or Overman. This is the higher type of human being, the one who does not rely on inherited beliefs or passive comfort. The Übermensch is someone who creates their own values, someone who lives with purpose not handed down from above, but born from within. In Prologue 4, Zarathustra says, "Man is a rope stretched between the animal and the Übermensch, a rope over an abyss." This is a striking metaphor. Humanity is not a finished product. We are not the end goal. We are a transition, a process, a bridge. And crossing that bridge requires danger, balance, and the constant risk of falling. The abyss beneath the rope is nihilism, the belief that life has no meaning, that nothing matters. The animal on one end of the rope represents instinct, survival, and nature. The Übermensch on the other side represents the possibility of a new kind of existence, one that is stronger, freer, and more creative. But there is no guarantee that the rope will be crossed. In fact, most people will not even try. They will turn away, step back, and live like the last man, because it is easier. Zarathustra tries to deliver this message to the people, but they laugh at him. He speaks to them of the Übermensch, but they misunderstand and mock him. They are not ready. This rejection is an important moment. It shows that truth, especially transformative truth, is rarely welcomed by the crowd. The herd prefers comfort to confrontation. Zarathustra must realize that his words are seeds planted in hard soil. They may take years to grow and they may be trampled before they even sprout. This theme of being rejected, of speaking truth into a deaf world, repeats throughout the book. Zarathustra is not a savior. He is a voice crying out in a world that no longer believes in voices. He is both ahead of his time and out of place in it. He knows that only a few will understand him. "I am not the mouth for these ears," he says. But still, he speaks. Still, he descends. Because the message matters more than the applause. The first part of Zarathustra's journey, then, is about this act of descent. This courageous decision to return to a world that has lost its way, to challenge it with a new vision. It's also about setting the stage for the core conflict of the book, the tension between what humanity is and what it could become. The rope, the abyss, the mocking crowd, all of these form the environment in which the idea of self-overcoming must take root. Nietzsche is not offering a roadmap. He is offering a mirror and asking whether you are willing to look into it and see not what you are, but what you must become. The prologue ends with a kind of resignation. Zarathustra sees that the people are not ready. He leaves the marketplace and decides to seek disciples, not to build a school or a church, but to find even a few individuals who are willing to walk the path of transformation. The story is just beginning, but already the tone is set. The way forward is not through society, but through the individual. Not through collective belief, but through personal strength. And that strength begins with the willingness to abandon everything false and step out over the abyss into the unknown. After Zarathustra's descent from the mountains and his failed attempt to awaken the crowd to the idea of the Übermensch, he turns inward again, but this time not into solitude, but into teaching. His journey shifts from confronting society at large to seeking those few individuals who might be capable of transformation. He knows now that the path to becoming who you are cannot be walked by the many. It can only be walked by the rare few. The ones willing to bear the weight of existence, destroy what they were taught to believe, and rebuild themselves from nothing. This process, painful, difficult, and deeply personal, is at the heart of the second section of Thus Spoke Zarathustra. Here, Nietzsche introduces some of the book's most powerful metaphors and teachings, beginning with one of the most important of all, the three metamorphoses of the spirit. Zarathustra describes the evolution a person must undergo to transform their spirit. The journey begins not with freedom or creativity, but with burden, the stage of the camel. The camel is the creature that says yes to responsibility. It kneels to take on heavy loads. It accepts the values of its culture, its religion, its teachers. It suffers and sacrifices. At this stage, we are obedient. We do what we're told. We carry ideals that were handed down to us. Be good, be moral, be humble, be selfless. There is a kind of nobility in this stage, but also a deep danger. because the camel accepts values uncritically, it confuses obedience with virtue, it does not yet think for itself. But Nietzsche does not reject the camel completely, he sees it as a necessary beginning. Before we can reject old values, we must first carry them, we must feel their weight, we must live under them long enough to recognize what they cost us. Only then can we move to the next stage, the stage of the lion. The lion is the rebel. It says no, not to life, but to the values that were imposed on it. The lion refuses to be ruled. It fights against tradition, against duty, against the inherited morality that kept it tied down. This stage is fiery, bold, and full of strength. But even the lion, Nietzsche says, cannot yet create. It is strong enough to destroy old values, but it lacks the innocence and playfulness needed to invent new ones. And that brings us to the final stage, the child. The child represents a return to innocence, but not ignorance. It is a symbol of creation, play, and fresh beginnings. The child is not bound by the past. It does not rebel for the sake of rebellion. It simply plays, imagines, and affirms life with a joyful yes. This is the spirit capable of creating new values, of becoming truly free. To create new values that even the lion cannot do, but the child is needed for that, Zarathustra says. The child is the final transformation, the self that no longer lives in reaction to what came before, but lives out of its own inner truth. This idea of transformation, of spiritual evolution, is one of Nietzsche's most important contributions. It's not enough to obey, and it's not enough to rebel. The real task is to move beyond both, to create. But this process is not easy, it is not given to us, it must be earned through struggle, and most people, Nietzsche believes, never make it past the camel stage. They carry their burdens until they break, or they rebel briefly, and then return to the safety of obedience. Very few reach the point of becoming the child, of living with creative freedom. In the chapters that follow, Nietzsche deepens this theme by turning his attention to the forces that prevent people from transforming. In On the Afterworldly, he criticizes religion, not simply for believing in a god, but for promoting the idea that life itself is something to be escaped. Many religions, Nietzsche argues, teach that true reality lies beyond this world, in a heaven or afterlife. This makes people resent the physical world, their bodies, their instincts. It turns them into what Nietzsche calls the afterworldly, people who despise life and long for escape. Zarathustra sees this as a form of spiritual sickness. It denies the value of existence in favor of a fantasy, and in doing so, it robs people of the will to live deeply, courageously, and creatively. Nietzsche's rejection of this life-denying attitude is not just intellectual, it is emotional, even personal. He is angry at how many people have been taught to feel shame about their desires, their impulses, their bodies. In On the Despisers of the Body, he writes, "Behind your thoughts and feelings, my brother, there stands a mighty ruler, the body." This is a direct attack on the dualism of body and mind. The idea, inherited from Plato and Christianity, that the soul is higher than the flesh. Nietzsche flips this completely. He argues that the body is not something we are trapped in. It is what we are. Our instincts, our emotions, our drive, these are not enemies to be controlled. They are the source of our wisdom. The spirit, he says, is simply a function of the body. To despise the body is to cut yourself off from your own power. This idea is incredibly liberating, but also incredibly dangerous, because it means that you must take full responsibility for yourself. You cannot rely on heaven or society or tradition to tell you how to live. You must look inward. You must listen to your body, your instincts, your deepest drives, and then shape your life around them. And that leads directly into the final chapter of this section, On the Way of the Creator. Here, Zarathustra speaks of the individual not as a follower or even a rebel, but as a creator. This is the highest ideal in Nietzsche's philosophy, the human being as a force of creation, not someone who copies values, but someone who invents them. The Creator does not ask for permission. He does not look for approval. He does not try to save the world or fix humanity. He simply brings new meaning into existence through the act of living. But this path is lonely. The Creator seeks companions, Zarathustra says, not corpses. He does not want disciples. He wants fellow creators, individuals strong enough to walk their own path, not cling to his. The path of the Creator is filled with uncertainty, with resistance, with doubt. But Nietzsche believes it is the only path worthy of a fully developed human being. The Creator must live in the present, grounded in the body, free from illusions about heaven or morality. He must affirm life, not just the beautiful parts, but the painful ones. And above all, he must be willing to create his own meaning, even if it means walking alone. Taken together, these chapters, the three metamorphoses, the critique of religion, the defense of the body, and the call to become a creator, form the foundation of everything that follows in the book. They are not easy teachings. They ask you to abandon safety, tradition, and comfort. They ask you to question everything you were taught. But in return, they offer something extraordinary. The possibility of becoming something more than you are, not through salvation, not through submission, but through creation, through the courage to look into yourself and to begin again. In part 2 of Thus Spoke Zarathustra, Nietzsche takes the reader deeper into the personal cost of transformation. The metaphor of the rope from the prologue, the idea that man is suspended between animal and Übermensch, becomes more real here. Because now Zarathustra is not only proclaiming bold ideas to the world, but wrestling with the loneliness, the frustration, and the psychological weight that comes with having stepped beyond the crowd. This section is about the inner landscape of someone who has rejected conventional life and is trying to build something new from scratch. It's not glamorous, it's not romantic, it's painful, isolating, and full of spiritual fire. Zarathustra begins by turning his attention to the so-called wise men of society, philosophers, teachers, religious leaders. In the chapter on the famous wise men, he dismantles their authority. These are the people who claim to possess wisdom, who supposedly teach others how to live. But Zarathustra sees them differently. He sees them as clinging to outdated systems of thought, afraid of new ideas, stuck in the comfort of tradition. They are clever, yes, but not courageous. They love rules more than life. Nietzsche argues that these so-called sages have turned philosophy into obedience. They disguise fear as virtue, weakness as humility. Rather than helping people think for themselves, they encourage dependence. Their wisdom is hollow, based not on experience or personal strength, but on the desperate need to feel superior while remaining safe. This is one of Nietzsche's most consistent criticisms, that morality, as commonly taught, is not actually moral. It's a mask for weakness. Instead of teaching people how to grow stronger, conventional wisdom teaches them how to feel righteous while avoiding the struggle required for real transformation. Zarathustra wants nothing to do with this kind of wisdom. He wants people to suffer honestly, to live courageously, and to question everything, even the things that have been called good for centuries. But this path, the path of truth, power, and independence, comes with a cost. In the chapter on the night song, Zarathustra speaks of a deep spiritual isolation. He says, "I am a forest and a night of dark trees, but he who is not afraid of my darkness will find banks full of roses under my cypresses." Here, Nietzsche shows that the person who tries to live beyond the herd who walks the path of self-overcoming will often be met not with applause, but with silence. The higher your vision, the fewer people will understand it. And this leads to a kind of loneliness that is not just social, it's existential. Zarathustra compares himself to the moon, shining in a dark sky, singing to a world that does not respond. His song is full of longing, of pain, and of a beauty that almost no one is ready to hear. This theme continues in On the Dancing Song, but now there's a shift. The pain of isolation does not lead Zarathustra to despair, it leads him to movement. Dancing becomes a metaphor for vitality, for the refusal to remain heavy or bitter. Even when alone, even when misunderstood, Zarathustra dances. But the soul of the dancer is in his own knees, he says. This means that joy does not depend on the approval of others. It comes from within. The dancer is someone who moves with grace despite the weight of the world, who refuses to be flattened by grief or loneliness. Dancing is not escape, it is resistance. It is saying yes to life, even when life is hard. It is a sign of inner power. And this is where Nietzsche begins to articulate one of his most important ideas, the will to power. In On the Tarantulas, Zarathustra attacks the morality of resentment, especially the kind promoted by those who appear to be champions of the oppressed. The tarantulas represent people who demand equality not because they value justice, but because they hate the strong. Their morality is driven not by love, but by revenge. They use the language of fairness to justify their desire to pull everyone down to their level. Zarathustra says, "The bite of conscience teaches man to bite." In other words, people who feel weak or ashamed often project that pain onto others. They moralize their hatred. Nietzsche is not saying that injustice doesn't exist. He's saying that many so-called moral crusades are really just disguises for bitterness and the desire for control. This is a hard teaching because it asks us to look at our motives honestly. Do we seek truth or do we seek power over others? Do we help the weak because we care or because we want to feel superior? Nietzsche believed that many of the moral ideals of society were based on fear and envy, not strength and courage. Zarathustra calls on us to go beyond this reactive morality, to live not out of resentment, but out of creative power. That power is explored further in On Self-Overcoming. Here, Nietzsche fully introduces the will to power as the deepest force in human nature. What is good? Zarathustra asks. All that heightens the feeling of power, the will to power, power itself in man. And what is bad? All that proceeds from weakness. This is not a call to domination. Nietzsche's idea of power is not about controlling others, it's about mastering oneself. The will to power is the drive to grow, to challenge oneself, to overcome limitations. It is the force behind all creativity, all ambition, all strength, and it is constantly at war with the forces of decay, comfort, and stagnation. Self-overcoming, then, is not a one-time event, it's a way of life. It means constantly questioning your own beliefs, your own habits, your own desires. It means embracing conflict and struggle, not because you enjoy pain, but because you understand that growth is impossible without it. You must burn in your own fire, Zarathustra says. You must be willing to let go of what no longer serves you, even if it once gave you meaning. You must be ruthless with yourself, not to punish yourself, but to free yourself. What Nietzsche is doing in this part of the book is showing the internal side of the transformation he described earlier. The first part dealt with metaphors: camels, lions, children. This part deals with the emotional and psychological reality of living those transformations. It's about the cost of freedom, the pain of solitude, the difference between false strength and true strength, and the constant temptation to fall back into comfort, resentment, or conformity. But it's also about the beauty that can emerge from that struggle, the dance, the song, the fire. Zarathustra may be alone, but he is not broken. He is singing in the night, he is still moving, he is still burning. And that, Nietzsche suggests, is the mark of someone who is becoming who they truly are. Not someone who has arrived, but but someone who is willing to keep going, no matter how dark the path gets. In the second half of part two of Thus Spoke Zarathustra, Nietzsche shifts the focus from the fight against external forces, against false morality, conformity, and shallow wisdom, to an even deeper and more personal struggle, the battle within the self. This is where the real test begins. It's no longer enough to reject what's outside. Now Zarathustra must deal with what's inside, his past, his fears, and his doubts. This part of the book introduces one of Nietzsche's most powerful and life-changing ideas, redemption not through guilt, but through affirmation. It also presents a pivotal moment in Zarathustra's inner development, a moment of silence, fear, and painful truth. In On Redemption, Zarathustra tackles the problem of regret and suffering in a radical new way. Most religious or moral systems tell us that redemption, or healing, comes through confession, repentance, or forgiveness. You admit your sins, you feel guilt, you apologize, and in that process, you're somehow made clean. But Nietzsche rejects this model entirely. To him, guilt is a form of weakness. It keeps us chained to the past, it focuses on what we cannot change, and in doing so, it saps our strength. Instead, he offers a new definition of redemption, the ability to affirm your life so completely that you would choose it exactly as it is again. This is not easy. It means embracing every mistake, every loss, every painful moment, not with bitterness, but with a kind of fierce acceptance. In one of the most important lines in the entire book, Zarathustra says, "To redeem the past and to transform every it was into thus I willed it, that alone do I call redemption." This is the voice of someone who refuses to be a victim, someone who takes full ownership of their life, even the parts they didn't choose. It's not about pretending that everything was good, it's about saying, "This is mine, I accept it, I own it, I will make something powerful out of it." This is a key part of Nietzsche's concept of the will to power. Not the desire to control others, but the inner force that pushes us to overcome, to create, to shape ourselves and our lives. When you can take your past with all its weight and darkness and still affirm it, when you can say yes to your life as a whole, that is true strength. That is the highest form of power. But Nietzsche also knows that this path is terrifying. In the chapter on human prudence, he speaks to the part of us that wants to play it safe. Prudence, caution, moderation, careful planning is often seen as a virtue, but Zarathustra mocks it. He calls it a clever cowardice. People who are too cautious, too calculating, never truly live. They avoid danger, yes, but they also avoid greatness. True life, Nietzsche says, requires risk. It requires throwing yourself into the unknown. It means making decisions that aren't always rational, but that are driven by the deeper forces of the soul. He writes, "Too much prudence is a kind of death," and he's right. When we overthink everything, when we try to control every outcome, we lose the wild, creative energy that gives life its meaning. Zarathustra urges us to break free from this fear-driven caution, to stop clinging to safety, and to trust the instincts and desires that call us forward, even when the path is unclear. All of this, the rejection of guilt, the call to affirm the past, the challenge to step beyond caution, leads to a powerful turning point in The Stillest Hour. This chapter is not about teaching others. It's about confronting yourself. Zarathustra finds himself alone, and in that silence he hears a voice, his own inner truth, speaking to him. But what it says is not comforting. It accuses him. It tells him that he has not been honest, that he has held back, that he has not yet spoken the deepest, most dangerous truths he carries. This is not an external enemy. This is not the crowd that laughed at him or the shallow thinkers he has mocked. This is Zarathustra's own fear, his own hesitation, and the voice says essentially, "You've come this far, but you're still afraid. You still want to be liked. You still want disciples. You have not yet gone far enough." The confrontation in the stillest hour is brutal, not because of violence, but because of its truth. Zarathustra must face the reality that even he, the prophet of transformation, is still clinging to comfort. He has not yet fully embraced his calling. He has not yet spoken with the absolute honesty that true creation demands. And now there is no turning back. The final lines of the chapter are among the most powerful in the entire book. The voice says, "Now I go alone, my disciples. You too go now, and alone. Thus I want it." Zarathustra realizes that the time for teaching is over. The time for being followed is over. The next stage of his journey must be walked alone, just as it must be for anyone who seeks to become more than what they were. The crowd cannot help you. Even your disciples, the ones who admire you, who listen to your words, can become a trap, because as long as you are trying to please them, you are not truly free. This is the final test of the will to power. Can you break even from those who look up to you? Can you let go of the need to be understood, to be liked, to be followed? Can you walk your path completely alone, guided only by your inner fire? Nietzsche is not glorifying isolation for its own sake. He's not saying that being alone is a virtue. What he's saying is that true transformation cannot happen unless you are willing to risk total independence. Unless you are willing to stop asking for permission, even from your past self. The stillest hour is the moment when the noise of the world fades and you are left face to face with what you know you must do and what you are most afraid to do. This moment marks a kind of spiritual noon in Zarathustra's life. It's the point where everything becomes clear and there's no going back. The light is harsh, the shadows are sharp, but the path is visible. From this point on, there is only forward, only the climb, only the long road toward becoming who you truly are, not in theory, but in action. So if you take one thing from this part of the book, let it be this. Redemption is not about forgiveness. It's about transformation. Power is not about controlling others. It's about mastering yourself. And the truth, the deepest truth, is not something you can share too soon. It must be earned, suffered for, and finally spoken when you are ready to walk alone. This is the turning point. This is where Zarathustra stops being a teacher and starts becoming something else, something harder, lonelier, and infinitely more real. This is where the fire gets hotter and the journey gets steeper, and from here everything that follows will demand more than just thought. It will demand action. It will demand you. In part 3 of Thus Spoke Zarathustra, Nietzsche introduces one of the most demanding and profound ideas in all of philosophy, the concept of eternal recurrence, sometimes called the eternal return. It is not presented as a dogma, not as something to believe in, but as a psychological experiment, a question meant to pierce through your daily habits, your self-deceptions, and the way you live your life. The idea is introduced slowly, surrounded by poetic imagery and layers of mystery, particularly in the chapters The Wanderer, The Vision and The Riddle, On Involuntary Bliss and Before Sunrise. This is the moment when Zarathustra and the reader must look directly into the abyss and ask, What if this moment returned to you forever? Would you still choose it? The idea is stated most clearly in The Vision and the Riddle. Zarathustra tells the story of a moment that comes upon him, alone on a mountain path, when he meets a dwarf, a symbolic figure who represents cleverness, reason, and perhaps the voice of doubt or intellect. Together, they approach a gate marked Moment. From this point stretches two roads, one into the past and one into the future. But Zarathustra's insight is that these two paths, though appearing separate, are in fact part of a circle. He says, "This long lane behind us, it goes on, it must go on, and if it goes on, it returns." And from this insight arises the terrifying, magnificent idea of eternal recurrence. He imagines that one day a demon may come to you in your loneliest hour and whisper, "This life as you now live it and have lived it, you will have to live once more and innumerable times more, and there will be nothing new in it, but every pain and every joy must return to you, all in the same sequence." The question Nietzsche poses is not about whether this is scientifically or cosmologically true. It is about how you would respond if it were. Would you curse the demon and collapse under the weight of your life being repeated endlessly? Or would you say, "You are a god, and never have I heard anything more divine"? This idea is meant to test the quality of your life, your choices, your values. It demands that you reflect on whether you are living in a way that you would be willing to repeat. Not once, but forever. Every small decision, every wasted hour, every regret, and every triumph. Would you endure it again? Could you love your fate, not just accept it, but embrace it so completely that you would welcome its eternal return? This is where Nietzsche's concept of amor fati, the love of fate, becomes essential. Amor fati is the attitude of someone who does not wish for a different life or for better circumstances, but who fully embraces what is, not because it's easy or pleasant, but because it is theirs. To love your fate means to say yes to every part of it, even the pain, even the failure. It's not about pretending things are good, it's about refusing to retreat from reality. Eternal recurrence is the ultimate expression of this idea. If you can say yes to your life being repeated forever, exactly as it is, then you have achieved something close to spiritual strength. But Nietzsche knows how rare this is. In The Wanderer, Zarathustra reflects on solitude, on walking alone, on the distance that grows between himself and others. The more deeply he understands, the more isolated he becomes. This is not loneliness in the social sense, it's philosophical solitude, the sense that few, if any, are willing to walk the path to its end. In that silence, in the long climb up the mountain, Zarathustra begins to wrestle with the thought of recurrence. He is not yet ready to affirm it. The idea frightens him. It presses on him like a weight too heavy to bear. This is what Nietzsche would later call the greatest weight, the burden of knowing that you are responsible not just for what happens now, but for choosing your life as a whole, eternally. In On Involuntary Bliss, Zarathustra catches a glimpse of what such affirmation might feel like. He experiences a strange moment of joy, a sense of harmony with the universe, a sense that he is exactly where he should be. But the bliss is not something he commands or controls. It arrives suddenly, uninvited, and leaves just as quickly. This fleeting glimpse of joy serves as a contrast to the still unresolved inner tension. Zarathustra is not yet fully at peace with the idea of recurrence. He has tasted the possibility of total affirmation, but it has not yet become his reality. Then, in Before Sunrise, Zarathustra speaks more directly about truth, light, and solitude. He reflects on the burden of seeing what others refuse to see, on the price of clarity. Truth, for Zarathustra, is not a cold set of facts. It is something alive, something he must wrestle with in the dark before the dawn. And yet, he begins to find something like peace, not comfort, but a fierce acceptance of the path he is on. He realizes that he must prepare himself for the final confrontation with recurrence. He must train his soul to say yes, not just to the easy moments, but to the whole of life. This is where the abyss comes in. The abyss is not some external place of suffering. It is the recognition that life contains both beauty and horror, and that there is no escape from that. It is the understanding that we are thrown into a world we did not choose, and yet we are asked to affirm it, to say yes without illusion, without lies, without hope of some other world where things are better. Eternal recurrence forces us to face the abyss, and then to step forward anyway. Throughout part 3, Nietzsche does not give us easy answers. Zarathustra is not triumphant here. He is reflective, vulnerable, questioning. He has spoken great truths, and now he must live them. This part of the book is quieter, more introspective, but also deeper. It shows the emotional and psychological cost of philosophical commitment. To believe in the Übermensch, to preach the will to power, these are bold, defiant ideas. But to live them day after day with no reward, no applause, and no certainty, that is something much harder. This is why Nietzsche says, "The higher man must suffer more than the lower." The more you see, the more you feel. The more responsibility you take, the more pressure you bear. Most people will never face the thought of eternal recurrence, not because they lack the intelligence, but because they lack the courage. It is easier to believe in a final reward, or a better world, or a second chance. But Zarathustra refuses those illusions. He chooses reality, even when it hurts. And that choice, Nietzsche suggests, is the mark of greatness. So this part of the book is not about resolution, it is about preparation. Zarathustra is not yet ready to fully embrace eternal recurrence, but he is approaching it. He is drawing nearer to the moment when he must make a decision that defines everything. Will he affirm his life, or will he collapse under the weight of it? Will he become the one who dances even at the edge of the abyss? Or will he retreat into comfort, into safety, into the crowd? We don't get the answer yet. That comes later. But here, in part 3, we are given the question. And it's not a question just for Zarathustra. It's a question for all of us. If your life, exactly as it is, were to repeat forever, would you rejoice? Would you curse it? Or would you change something today so that the next time the demon comes, you can say yes, not out of pride, but out of truth? This is the challenge of eternal recurrence. This is the test Nietzsche gives us, and it is not a test you pass once, it is a test you face every single day. In part 4 of Thus Spoke Zarathustra, Nietzsche brings Zarathustra into contact with the so-called higher men, figures who are more developed, more reflective, and perhaps more courageous than the average person, but who still fall short of becoming the Übermensch. These characters are not villains, nor are they fools. In fact, they are tragic in a different way. They have tried to rise above the herd, and in doing so, they've become stuck in a different kind of trap. Spiritual pride, vanity, or ideological delusion. This section is one of the strangest and most complex in the entire book. It is filled with satire, symbolism, and irony. But beneath the strange scenes and characters is a clear message. Not all rebellion leads to transformation. Not all suffering leads to wisdom. And not all who seem high have truly overcome themselves. The chapter, The Cry of Distress, marks a turning point. Zarathustra hears a cry and follows it, expecting perhaps to find someone in need of guidance. Instead, he finds a man broken by the weight of truth. Someone who has seen too much, who has tried to rise but has fallen into despair. This sets the stage for the parade of higher men who follow. One by one they appear. They are kings who have lost their kingdoms, priests who have lost their faith, poets who are trapped in their own illusions, magicians who can no longer believe in their tricks. Each one represents a type of person who has tried to go beyond common life, but has failed in a subtle, tragic way. In conversation with the kings, Zarathustra meets rulers who have grown tired of ruling. These are not tyrants, but worn-out men, men who once held power and influence, but who now seek something more. They admire Zarathustra because he represents freedom, a kind of spiritual nobility they've lost. But they also speak words that reveal their own emptiness. One of them says something close to, "What do we matter? Let the herd perish, but let the Übermensch live." This line sounds noble, but Nietzsche is pointing out a hidden danger, the temptation to care more about an idea than about people. The kings are no longer concerned with leading or improving the world. They've retreated into ideology. They want to see the birth of the Übermensch, but not to become him. They admire greatness, but they no longer strive for it. They have become spectators, not creators. Then comes the magician. This character is a clear reference to Richard Wagner, the famous composer and former friend of Nietzsche. The magician is an artist who dazzles with emotion and spectacle, but who lacks real depth. He weeps, he sings, he seduces the audience, but Zarathustra sees through it. He knows that beneath all the drama is weakness. The magician performs suffering instead of confronting it. He turns pain into a show. Nietzsche is warning us here about the danger of aestheticizing suffering, of turning real struggle into something shallow or performative. This is not true transformation. It is spiritual theatrics. What unites all these higher men is that they have each, in some way, touched the edge of greatness, but then retreated. They have suffered, yes. They have left the herd. They have seen truths that others ignore. But they have not gone far enough. They have not overcome themselves. They have not become free. Their pride, their roles, their identities keep them stuck. Zarathustra sees this and feels the weight of it. He had hoped to find allies, but instead he finds half-transformed beings, people who are still trapped in ego, memory, or the need to be admired. This brings us to the strange and satirical chapter, The Ass Festival. It's one of the most confusing scenes in the entire book, and intentionally so. The higher men, in an effort to celebrate, end up conducting a parody of a religious ceremony centered around a donkey. They bow to it, they sing to it, they make it the object of their devotion. This scene is absurd, almost cartoonish, but it's also deeply meaningful. Nietzsche is showing us that even those who have rejected traditional religion can easily fall into new forms of worship, just as empty, just as blind. The donkey represents stupidity, obedience, and herd-like thinking. And yet, here are the supposed higher men bowing to it. Why? Because the human impulse to bow, to worship, to follow is hard to kill. Even after God is dead, people still seek new idols. Nietzsche mocks this impulse mercilessly. The satire in The Ass Festival is not just aimed at others, it's a test for the reader too. Can you laugh at this scene? Can you see yourself in it? Have you ever replaced one system of belief with another, thinking it was your own, when it was just a new form of submission? Nietzsche is not trying to humiliate his characters, he's trying to wake us up. He's saying, even those on the path can fall. Even those who have suffered can still be cowards. Even those who seem wise can still be fools. And this brings us to one of the most painful insights in this section. Suffering alone is not enough. Nietzsche acknowledges that all these men have suffered deeply, but he also shows that suffering by itself does not transform you. It can make you bitter. It can make you proud. It can trap you in a story about how special or broken you are. True transformation only comes when suffering is used, not as a badge of honor, but as fuel, as raw material for creating something stronger. This is the deeper meaning of the line. All of them have suffered deeply, but it is suffering that creates transformation. Not suffering in itself, but suffering that is overcome, absorbed, and turned into power. By the end of these encounters, Zarathustra is weary. He realizes that he cannot lead these men any more than he could lead the crowd. He understands that each person must walk the path alone. Even those who seem close to the summit can still fall. The temptation to stop, to settle, to admire the view rather than keep climbing, it's everywhere. Zarathustra sees it, and he decides once again to retreat, to reflect, and to wait for the moment when he himself is ready to speak the deepest truths. Because even he, for all his insight, is still evolving. He is not finished. And this, perhaps, is Nietzsche's most humble message. The work of becoming never ends. This part of the book serves as a warning. It's not enough to be different. It's not enough to be wounded. It's not enough to reject the herd. What matters is what you do with your suffering, your insight, your solitude. Do you use it to rise, or do you turn it into a mask, a performance, or an excuse to feel superior? True transformation is subtle. It is often invisible. It does not bow to donkeys or chase applause or cling to pain like a trophy. It moves quietly. It burns inwardly. It rises not from status, but from the unshakable will to become. The higher men in Zarathustra's world are not villains. They are mirrors. They show us what happens when the journey is interrupted, when courage gives way to comfort, when ego gets mistaken for strength. And through them, Nietzsche asks us a question that echoes through the entire book. Will you stop here, or will you go further? That is the true final trial, not a battle with others, but a battle with the voice inside that says, "This is enough." Nietzsche's answer, through Zarathustra, is clear. It is never enough. The path continues. The fire must burn hotter, and the real work is still ahead. In the final two chapters of Thus Spoke Zarathustra, Nietzsche brings everything to a climax, not through argument, not through a final lesson or a moral conclusion, but through an emotional, poetic outpouring of joy, affirmation, and rebirth. These closing scenes, the drunken song and the sign, are filled with images of light, laughter, dancing, animals, eternity, and transformation. But they are not a retreat into fantasy or comfort. They are the result of everything that came before. The descent into solitude, the confrontation with suffering, the rejection of false prophets, the struggle with eternal recurrence. Zarathustra has endured all of it. Now, at last, he reaches a new kind of strength, a strength that doesn't come from conquering, resisting, or teaching, but from loving life exactly as it is. This is the moment of his rebirth. The Drunken Song is not a song of chaos or mindless pleasure. It is the song of someone who has seen the worst of life, its pain, its repetition, its absurdity, and still chooses to say yes. This yes is not naive. It is not shallow. It is the yes of someone who has walked through fire and come out the other side, not untouched, but stronger. Zarathustra now sings of joy. But this joy is not ordinary happiness. It is deeper. It is cosmic. It is tied to the very structure of time and being. All joy wants eternity, wants deep eternity, he declares. This line repeats like a chant, like a heartbeat. What does it mean? It means that true joy, the kind of joy that affirms life, does not want to pass away. It wants to last forever. It wants to be repeated. In other words, true joy is the acceptance of eternal recurrence. When you love something so much that you want it not just once, but again and again forever, then you have truly loved it. Then you have truly said yes to life. This is the final test that Zarathustra now passes. After all the struggle, the sorrow, the disappointment, he is now able to not just accept recurrence, but to rejoice in it. The demon from earlier, the one who whispered the terrifying possibility of eternal return, no longer frightens him. Zarathustra's answer is no longer hesitation or dread. His answer is yes. But this yes is not abstract. It is expressed through song, dance, and laughter. Nietzsche believed that the highest form of wisdom is not heavy, it is light. Not because it ignores suffering, but because it carries it with strength. The image of Zarathustra dancing is one of the most important in the whole book. It connects back to earlier chapters, where he said that he would only believe in a God who could dance. Dancing is a metaphor for freedom, for grace, for moving with life instead of against it. To dance is to live without stiffness, without fear. And now, at the end, Zarathustra dances with eternity. He is no longer burdened by the past. He is no longer worried about convincing others. He is no longer looking backward or forward. He is present, alive, joyful. This is also where we see the fulfillment of an earlier image from The Vision and the Riddle. In that earlier chapter, Zarathustra described a shepherd with a snake in his throat, a symbol of the horror of recurrence, the feeling of being trapped in something you cannot escape. The snake represents the cycle, the loop, the unbearable repetition. But then Zarathustra cries out to the shepherd to bite, to take action, to affirm, to own what is happening. The shepherd bit as my cry had advised him. He bit with a good bite. That moment of biting is the turning point, the moment when the horror is overcome, not by escape, but by courage, by embracing it. And now, in the drunken song, we see what happens after the bite. Freedom. Zarathustra is free because he no longer wishes for life to be different. He no longer fights against time or pain or the past. He accepts the eternal return not as a punishment, but as the deepest expression of life's beauty. He has reached Amor Fati in its purest form, the love of fate. The final chapter, The Sign, brings this transformation into a symbolic, almost mythical conclusion. Zarathustra wakes up and his animals, the eagle and the serpent, bring him a sign. What is the sign? It's not fire from the heavens or a voice from the sky. It is something small, almost playful. The animals laugh. They celebrate. They are light. And Zarathustra understands that the time of heavy burdens is over. The time of teaching is over. This is my morning. My day begins. Arise now. Arise. Great noon, he says. The great noon is not just the middle of the day. It is the moment of clarity, of culmination, of pure presence. This declaration, my day begins, is not about going back to the world to teach more disciples or spread a message. It is about living, fully, without hesitation. Zarathustra has let go of everything, the need to be understood, the need to be followed, the need to explain. What remains is pure affirmation. He does not just preach eternal recurrence, he lives it. He has become the embodiment of Nietzsche's ideal. Not a god, not a guru, but a human being who has overcome the past, overcome fear, and become whole. There's something paradoxical here. The man who once came down from the mountains to teach others has now gone beyond teaching. He no longer needs an audience. His joy is self-sufficient. His life is its own answer. And that is the deepest transformation of all. Nietzsche ends the book not with a conclusion, not with a summary, but with a feeling. The feeling of waking up after a long darkness, of laughing after deep grief, of dancing after pain. Zarathustra has been reborn, not into a new doctrine, but into a new way of being. So what does all of this mean for us? It means that the path to becoming who you are is not a straight line. It means that suffering is not the end, nor is solitude or rejection or doubt. All of these are stages, necessary fires. And if you endure them honestly, without turning away, something new emerges, not a perfect person, not a master, but a self who can finally say yes to their life, not because it was easy, but because it was theirs. Nietzsche doesn't offer comfort, he offers challenge. But at the end of that challenge is not despair, it is joy, a joy that dances. A joy that wants eternity. Thus Spoke Zarathustra ends not with answers, but with a return to life, and that perhaps is the most important lesson of all. No matter how far you go, no matter how high you climb, no matter how deep you suffer, the goal is not to escape life, but to return to it, to say yes to it, to affirm it, and to live it again and again and again. Will you say yes? Will you bite the snake? Will you dance at the edge of the abyss? That is the question Nietzsche leaves us with, and only you can answer it.